whose mind was closed to her, and who had shown her what was undoubtedly only ordinarily polite attention, and her imagination was running away with her. Ben needed her to help catch a madman threatening his town, and that was the only reason he needed her. His devotion to this town and its people was strong, his abhorrence of insane killers even stronger, and in her abilities lay possible tools for him to use to protect the former and destroy the latter. That was all. Having reached that conclusion, Cassie tried to stop thinking about it. About him. She got up and dressed, then put the coffee on, got her boots from the laundry room, and took Max out for his morning run. It had snowed about 4 inches. Not so much that it made walking difficult, but just enough to cover the winter-flattened grass of the fields with a blanket of pristine white. The bare limbs of the hardwood trees were frosted with a thin layer, while the pines so common in the state bore the weight of snow on drooping boughs that appeared to slump in weariness. Cassie watched Max dash around happily, then lifted her gaze to the mountains. Ryan's Bluff was nestled in a valley, high up against a shoulder of the Appalachians. Normally, the view of the mountains was pleasant and often a bit hazy, but today the dull green and brown was dusted with snow, and the cold, clear air made the hulking shapes seem to loom nearer than they actually were. As she stared up at them, Cassie's smile of pleasure faded. For the first time, they felt threatening, brooding down on the valley and the town with an almost malevolent stare, watching her. Just as she had in Ivy Jameson's kitchen, she felt a pressure in or on her chest, at first barely noticeable, but intensifying slowly. The chill of the ground seemed to sweep upward from her boots in a wave that left behind it cold flesh and quivering muscles. The crisp white landscape surrounding her took on a dingy gray hue, as though a fog had moved in, and a dull roaring sound grew louder in her ears. She had the sense of something beating up against her like fluttering wings, trying to get in, and the touch of it was as icy as the grave. The sensations were so unsettling and unfamiliar that Cassie didn't know what to do. She was afraid to lower her guard, to open herself up, and let whatever it was touch her mind. But as wary and fearful as she was, experience had taught her that struggling against any attempt to contact her would only prolong the situation and possibly make it impossible for her to control what happened, if she could control it. Cassie drew a breath and let it out slowly, watching it turn to mist before her face. Then she closed her eyes and opened herself to whatever it was that demanded her attention. Ben tossed the plastic evidence bag onto Sheriff Dunbar's desk and said, "Cassie may not mind, but I really don't appreciate your sense of humor, Matt."
"Excuse me?"
Matt was wonderfully polite. "Don't play innocent, it's not your best face. That scrap of cloth is from your old Boy Scout uniform."
"So she got that, huh?"
Matt said as Ben sat down in his visitor's chair. "She got it. Said the cloth was only evidence of your sense of humor, which she had doubted until then."
Matt smiled, but then quickly frowned.
"She said it wouldn't convince you."
Ben was watching him.
"But that it might at least give you pause. For Christ's sake, Matt, what's it going to take?"
Matt ignored the question. "Following up on the coins hasn't given us squat. For one thing, all the collectors we've talked to so far have been middle-aged or older, all apparently happily married with kids, and not so much as a traffic ticket among them.
And so nowhere near the profile."
"If I accept the profile, yes."
"Do you? And will you finally admit we have a serial killer?"
Matt hesitated. "I may be stubborn, but I'm no fool, Ben. The only real connection between the three victims is their sex and race, and the fact that we can't find, in any of their pasts, an enemy angry enough or with any other kind of motive to kill any of them. Which means it's looking more and more likely all three were killed by a stranger, or at least by someone they hardly knew. Which points to a serial killer. I don't see any other option, goddammit, Matt sighed explosively. They used to call them stranger killings. Did you know that? Before somebody coined the term serial killer, the most difficult kind of murder to solve because the killer has no tangible connection with his victim. Ben nodded. I've been doing some reading on the subject, especially since Ivy and Jill were killed. Sounds like you have as well. For all the good it's done me, all I end up with is that pathetically thin profile your damned psychic offered after Becky was killed. White male, between 24 and 32. Probably single and unlikely to be involved with a woman. Probably from an abusive background, with at least one domineering parent. Probably with sexual problems. Hell, I probably speak to the guy when I pass him on the streets. Ben could understand the sheriff's frustration, because he shared it. Worst of all, Matt said gloomily, yesterday, I heard at least three people mention the phrase serial killer, and once that spreads, things are going to get crazy around here very fast. Say we've got a murderer running around and people get upset. Say it's a serial killer, and they go nuts. It's like yelling shark at the beach. Most of the women seem to be taking care. At least we've got that, Ben offered. I don't think I've seen one walking alone all week. Matt grunted. It's not much to brag about, Ben. The bald truth is that we're no closer to finding this guy than we were last week when Becky was killed. And you know as well as I do that the longer we go on without a break in the case, the less likely it is that we'll ever get this bastard. We catch killers because they leave evidence we can interpret or they do something stupid. This one has done neither. Maybe he'll kill again. Get cocky enough to leave us some helpful evidence. Or maybe three was his limit. Now he's just sitting back, watching us stumble around in the dark. Cassie thinks he isn't finished yet. Oh, shit. The sheriff didn't sound so much disgusted as despairing. Keeping his tone as neutral as possible, Ben said, if we're going to take advantage of her abilities, we'd better do it soon. The longer this goes on, the more likely it is that this bastard could catch Cassie in his mind and recognize her as a threat. Matt stared at him. You've been reading up on psychics as well as serial killers, haven't you? Ben didn't deny it. The consensus seems to be that some people are abnormally sensitive to the electromagnetic energies of the brain. Through one conduit or another, they're able to tap into the energies of other people's minds and read them. Interpret them as thoughts and images, and even emotions. What do you mean by conduit? This sounded more like science, and a lot less like magic, so Matt was at least inclined to listen. What Cassie called connections, physical touch, either of a person or some object he or she has touched, is most common. It's rare for a psychic to be able to tap into another mind without being in some kind of contact. But for a few psychics, and I think Cassie's among them, once that contact has occurred and lasted long enough, it seems to leave a sort of map or trail behind, like a faint stream of energy connecting the two minds. After that, it's possible for the psychic to follow the trail virtually at will. Ben paused. Unfortunately, it's also possible for the target mind to identify that connection. Maybe even follow it back to the psychic. Even if he isn't psychic? Matt asked intently. There's some speculation that the mind of a serial killer is so abnormal that their thoughts literally misfire, so that the electromagnetic energy spills into the brain and causes changes at the molecular level. Just the way a head injury can trigger latent psychic abilities by jolting the brain, so can these misfires. Over a period of time, the serial killer can actually become psychic. If that's so, And if this killer is as young as Cassie believes, it may be only a matter of time before he can follow the trail back to her. Assuming he doesn't read her name in the paper first, Matt commented dryly. That's the other risk, and probably a more likely one. Sooner or later, word will get around that Cassie is psychic and that we've been talking to her. Won't that look just dandy at the next election? If we put this killer behind bars, Ben reminded him, I doubt very much the voters will care how we did it. Maybe. But in the meantime, we'll take a lot of flack. And your psychic will take center stage. Stop calling her my psychic. You know her name. Matt eyed him. Touchy, aren't you? This is not about me. Are you going to ask Cassie for help, or aren't you? Rather mildly, Matt said, Yes, I am. Ben blinked. And just when did you make up your mind about that? Matt fingered the evidence bag still lying on the blotter in front of him. When you told me she knew this came from my old Boy Scout uniform. Like you said. Like she said. I'm not convinced. But I can't think of a single trick or deception to explain how she could identify this correctly. Except that she knew. Taken with the rest, it's enough to make me want to find out what else she knows. It's about time. Well, don't just sit there staring at me. Call her. At first, Cassie was aware of nothing except the cold. Far beyond the chill of snow and wind, this cold was absolute. It felt, she imagined, the way the biting touch of deep space would feel against cringing human flesh. She had the hazy idea that even the blood in her veins was slowing, turning to slush as the cold reached it. The fluttering sensation returned, intensified for a moment, then faded, and she felt something else. Someone else. Cassie opened her eyes slowly. Around her, the air remained gray and foggy. She was distantly aware of the dog barking frantically, but didn't see him. She turned her head slowly toward the woods, where more pines than hardwood trees made the area dark and gloomy with the canopy of their heavy branches. The people were standing just inside the woods. There must have been a dozen of them, mostly women, but a few men as well, and at least one young boy. They watched her with eyes as profoundly reproachful as those Ivy Jameson had aimed across her kitchen at Cassie days before. When they started moving slowly toward her, Cassie saw the wounds. One woman's throat gaped open. Another's head was misshapen, a horrible depression of the skull crying mutely of a heavy object in terrible force. One man carried his own bloody arm, while another held his hands protectively over the inches-wide gash that opened him from chest to crotch. They walked toward her steadily, emerging from the shadows of the woods and into the field with its gray snow and foggy air, and that appalling coldness came off them in waves that were almost visible. They left no footprints in the snow. Cassie heard a faint whimpering sound and realized it was coming from her own throat. It was a pathetic substitute for the scream crawling around deeper inside her. She was frozen, immobile. She couldn't run away or back away, or even throw up an arm to try to protect herself. All she could do was stand there and wait for them to reach her, to touch her. Chapter 11. When Cassie opened her eyes, she wasn't immediately sure either where she was or how she had gotten there. The tiled ceiling above her looked vaguely familiar, and she eventually identified it as that of the living room of Aunt Alex's house. Her house. Odd. The last thing she remembered was getting up that morning, putting the coffee on, she could smell it, and taking Max out for his run. And then, nothing. So you're back. She turned her head toward the voice and realized several things simultaneously. She was wrapped from head to foot in a thick blanket. She was lying on the sofa with her head and shoulders propped up with pillows, and she was so incredibly cold that shivers racked her body in waves. The sheriff stood at the fireplace, in which a fire blazed. He had one shoulder propped against the mantel, his hands in the pockets of his black jacket, and one eye on the big dog that sat only a couple of feet away, staring at him with a distinctly hostile attitude. "Ben didn't have time to introduce us," Matt told her somewhat dryly, as her gaze shifted to the dog. "Good thing this mutt already knew him, though. Otherwise, neither of us would have been able to get near you."
"Near me? Where was I?"
Her voice sounded a bit shaky, she thought, but considering the chills, that was hardly surprising. He took her bafflement in stride. "Out in the field north of here, about 100 yards from the house, lying unconscious in the snow, with the dog standing guard over you and barking his head off."
"Unconscious?"
She thought about that, then shook her head.
"Where's Ben?"
"In the kitchen. Either hot chocolate or hot soup, whichever he could fix the quickest." Conversationally, Matt went on. "When you didn't answer your phone, Ben was convinced something had happened. So we came out here. Heard the dog as soon as we got out of the car, and spotted you a couple of minutes later. When we got to you and managed to get past the dog, it was obvious you weren't in good shape. You were about 2 shades paler than the snow. Your pulse was faint, and about 20 beats a minute, and you were barely breathing. If I hadn't been able to convince Ben you just needed to get warm, you'd be on your way to the hospital right now."
"How did you know that's all I needed?"
Matt frowned slightly. "That's hard to explain. I just looked at you, and I could swear I heard a voice in my head saying the word cold, over and over. Your voice."
That didn't surprise Cassie very much. Even though she still didn't remember what had happened, if she had reached out unconsciously for help, it would have been the sheriff, with his unshuttered mind, who would have been able to hear her.
"Thank you, Sheriff," she said.
"Don't mention it. And the name's Matt."
She decided not to question his apparent change of sentiments. Instead, she said to the softly growling dog,
"Max, he's a friend. Be a good boy and lie down."
The dog turned his alert attention to her, but obediently lay down where he was, his tail thumping the floor.
"Thank you," Matt said. "He was making me nervous."
Before Cassie could respond, Ben came into the room carrying a mug. He wasn't dressed for court. The casual jeans and sweatshirt he wore took years off his age and made him seem unnervingly approachable. He had obviously heard their voices and wasn't surprised to find her awake, but his face was grim. The gaze he fixed on her was so intense she had to look away. He sat down on the sofa alongside her legs and held the mug to her lips.
"Drink this, Cassie. It'll help warm you."
It was hot chocolate, and it was either very good or she was very cold and thirsty. She took a couple of swallows, then managed to get her hands out from under the blanket and took the mug from him. It was no accident that she didn't touch him at all in the process.
"Thanks. I can manage."
Ben didn't protest or even comment. He just sat there, one hand on the back of the sofa and the other on his knee, and stared at her without speaking. She knew he was staring, because she could feel it. Matt said,
"So far, she doesn't remember what happened out there."
"What do you remember?" Ben asked her.
Cassie frowned at the mug. The hot liquid was warming both her chilled hands and her shivering body, but she knew it would be a long time before she felt warm again.
"I remember going out to take Max for his morning run. I remember walking away from the house, looking up at the mountains."
"Cassie?"
She caught her breath, her eyes closing as sensations and images stepped out of hiding in her mind.
"Oh, God, I remember," she whispered.
"Tell us."
Ben's voice was quiet. It took a moment for Cassie to get her voice under control, and when she finally began speaking,
She reported her experience without emotion. It wasn't until she reached the end of the story that her voice broke slightly. They were coming toward me, and I couldn't run away. I couldn't even scream. I just kept getting colder and more terrified the closer they got. Then, just before they reached me, everything went black. I don't remember anything else. She didn't have to look at Matt to know that he was torn between bafflement and disbelief. She sneaked a glance at Ben and found him still watching her, his expression no less grim than it had been, his eyes unreadable. She had no idea what he was thinking or feeling. Matt said, "So these people were ghosts?" "I guess."
"You guess?"
Cassie turned her gaze to the sheriff, finding it easier to meet his incredulous eyes than Ben's unfathomable ones. "Yes, I guess. I don't know for sure, because this has never happened to me before." She drew a breath. "Look, my abilities have never allowed me to cross beyond death. I'm not a medium. I pick up thoughts from living beings, images from events that are happening or have recently happened. I don't know anything about ghosts."
"What about what you saw at Ivy's house? You said it was possible you could have been seeing what her spirit saw moments after her death."
She hesitated. "I said it was possible, but I didn't believe it. Even though it felt so strange, I was sure what I saw that day came from the memories of a living person who stood there and looked at the murder scene. But some of the things I felt today were similar to what I felt that day. And I don't think they were memories." She shook her head. "I just don't know."
"If what you saw were ghosts," Ben said, "who were they?"
"I didn't recognize any of them. But they'd all been murdered, I think." Matt swore under his breath.
"I thought you said this killer of ours was new at the job. If he's killed a dozen people..."
Cassie hesitated again, then shook her head. "I don't think they were his victims. I mean, when I stood in Mrs. Jameson's kitchen, it was as if I tapped into somebody studying the scene, almost as if I saw it the way he had, from his perspective. The dripping blood so vividly scarlet, the body with its eyes turned toward me in reproach. It was very dramatic, those images. Almost as if the whole thing had been staged to elicit a strong emotional response. I had that same feeling today, or almost. As if I were seeing something conjured out of some black hell of fantasy. Not the ghosts of victims past, but more like a cast of characters he was imagining."
"The ghosts of victims' future," Ben said.
"Maybe."
She didn't look at him.
"But it was more like some adolescent psychopath's wet dream." Even as the words left her lips, Cassie felt a flash of pained humor. Virginal she might be, but innocent she definitely was not. A line from an old movie sprang into her head, something about being an unholy mess of a girl. That was her. The silence dragged on for just a moment too long, and it was Cassie who broke it by saying calmly, "Now that I think about it, they're coming toward me like that, bleeding and carrying parts of themselves. Reminds me of a horror movie I saw years ago about the dead being reanimated. Our killer might well enjoy dreams like that."
"So now you're in his dreams?" Matt demanded.
"Could be. I was up early. Maybe he slept late. And dreamed."
"And you tapped in."
Ben's voice was still quiet. Matt made a little sound that was a combination of amusement and despair.
"Cassie, you're making it real hard for me to believe any of this."
"I know. I'm sorry." She turned her head and smiled faintly at him. "Nothing's ever as simple as you want it to be."
"Ain't it the truth?"
"Look,
We came out here because I was going to ask you to try to tap into this guy again. But obviously, I can try.
Ben said, you're still shivering.
Cassie didn't look at him. I'm fine. A little cold, but not even tired.
Matt glanced from her face to Ben's and hesitated. We can wait and do it tomorrow. Lying out there in the snow didn't do you any good at all, no matter what caused it.
I'd rather try now. Cassie kept her voice level. I need to be in control of this, or at least as much as I can be. I need to be the one instigating the contact.
Matt waited a moment, but when Ben said nothing, agreed with a nod. I have one of the coins with me, but...
But?
Well, Ben said he thought that eventually you'd be able to tap into this guy at will without touching something he touched. I'm just wondering if you can do that now.
Cassie glanced at Ben, then handed the mug to him, again taking care not to touch him. Let's try.
Have you ever done it before? Ben asked, sounding a bit rough around the edges.
No, never tried to before. But since his unconscious mind seems to be reaching me all too easily, I'm curious to find out if I can.
Matt finally left the fireplace, hitching a wing chair closer to the sofa where he'd have a clear view of Cassie. He pulled out his notebook and a pen with a muttered, just in case, and then waited expectantly. Ben set the mug on the coffee table, but didn't move from his place beside her on the couch.
Cassie put her hands back under the blanket and closed her eyes, trying to relax, to concentrate. It was difficult with Ben so close. He virtually trapped her on the sofa, but years of practice enabled her to push away even that distracting realization. Imagery had always helped Cassie to focus on what she was trying to do, though holding some object had tended to speed the process, so that her images were swiftly replaced by those seen through the eyes of killers. This time, she conjured the image of a path through a peaceful forest and began following it. Nothing yanked at her. No dark voice whispered to her. As she walked, she looked around, interested but at ease. Whenever she came to a path leading in a different direction, she allowed her instincts to decide whether she should take it, sometimes doing so, and other times walking past. The cheerful bird sounds began to fade, and the woods grew darker.
Cassie?
Ben's voice, curiously distant and hollow in the forest. I'm not there yet, she told him, vaguely aware that he was coming with her on the journey.
Where are you?
Following the path. She felt herself frown. It's an odd path.
In what way?
Dunno exactly. Just feels strange.
Tell me.
She sighed a bit impatiently. The ground is all spongy, and it smells odd, like inside a musty closet. And the light seems to be coming from two different directions. I'm casting two shadows. Isn't that strange?
Do you hear anything?
I did hear the birds, but now there's just the music.
What music?
I think it's from a music box. I can't remember the tune, though. I should, but I can't.
All right. If you remember, tell me.
I will. She walked on, noting without any sense of uneasiness the way the trees around her began to assume twisted shapes like nothing in nature.
Cassie?
What?
Where are you?
She was about to report that she was still in the forest, but before she could, she came to a distinct fork in the path. Her instincts had nothing to say about the matter, so Cassie flipped a mental coin and picked the right-hand path.
Cassie, talk to me.
The path forked. Two roads diverged in a wood. I went right. It was the less traveled path.
Cassie, I think it's time to turn around and come back.
She realized he was worried,
and tried to make her voice reassuring. I'm all right. And besides, I'm nearly there.
What do you see?
A door.
In the middle of the woods?
Until he asked the question, Cassie hadn't considered it odd, but now she stared at the very large door that appeared to be made of solid oak. I could go around it, but I think I'm supposed to go through it.
Be careful.
It took some time to find the knob, especially since it wasn't a knob at all, but a lever hidden cunningly in the wood. She pressed it with a sense of triumph and then pushed open the door. The forest was gone. Ahead of her stretched a bare hallway with doors opening off to the left and right. It smelled even more like the inside of a long-forgotten closet. With a sigh, she started walking.
Cassie?
There's a hallway with lots of doors. I'm walking straight down the hall. Damn. This is much faster when I have a guide.
A guide?
Something of his. Never mind. I've gone this far and... She had opened the door at the end of the long hallway, and the instant she did, the journey was complete. Oh.
Cassie, what is it? No hallway. No woods. No comforting images. Just the oppressive weight of him around her, the unnerving awareness of another consciousness surrounding her own, and seeing what he saw because she had no other choice.
It's him.
All traces of reassurance and lightness were stripped from her. Where is he?
A room. Just a room. Drawn curtains, lamps. There's a bed. He's sitting on the bed.
What's he doing, Cassie?
She had come upon him so suddenly that she was wary of giving away her presence, and so tried to keep very still and quiet. He's making something.
What is he making?
She was silent for a few beats, and then her breath caught in her throat. It's a piece of wire with a wooden handle on each end. He's making a garrote.
Are you sure?
Very sure. I've seen one before.
All right. Can you look around, Cassie? Can you tell us more?
I can only see what he sees. And he's looking at his hands, watching them caress the weapon. He likes it.
Look at his hands. Study them. What can you tell us about them?
Young. Strong. No scars except the inside of each wrist. He bites his nails, but they're clean. Nothing else.
Do you know what he's thinking?
I'm afraid to listen.
You have to, a new voice ordered. Matt, stay out of this. Cassie, don't listen to him unless you're sure you can do it safely.
I think I can hide from him, but...
But what?
She felt forlorn. Nothing. I'll listen.
Be careful.
Cassie made herself very small and very still, and cautiously listened. At first, the racket of his thoughts was like static on a radio, crackling painfully in her mind, but slowly the snapping and popping faded as she was able to sift through all the background noise. He's thinking about what he's going to do to her.
To who? Who is he thinking about, Cassie?
He's... There's no identity, just her. That's the way he thinks of her. She is going to be sorry. She is going to be so surprised.
She is going to die for a long time. Shit. Matt.
Cassie,
Is he thinking anything else that might help us? About a place or a particular day? Just soon. He's eager to do it. And this time, he wants his hands on her when she dies. That's why the garrote. He wants to feel her. Oh, Christ. Cassie crept from his mind as fast as she dared, and once she was out, the hallway and the forest path sped by in a blur. And then she was back inside herself. Her body felt cold and queasy, and much more tired than it had before. But at least she was back.
Cassie?
She opened her eyes slowly and looked at Ben. He was unusually pale, she realized. Had her horror sounded as overwhelming as it had felt? I'm sorry. Her voice sounded damnably weak, but there was nothing she could do about it. I couldn't stay there. It was Matt who asked.
What was he thinking? What was it you couldn't bear to hear?
She drew a breath and tried to hold her voice steady. This one he means to rape. He wants to be inside her when she dies.
Ben made a rough sound, but Cassie kept her gaze on the sheriff. Matt's face was grim. But you have no idea who it is he'll go after?
No. I think he's already picked her, though. The sense of anticipation was strong. It was like the feeling I got the first time, when he was watching Becky. I'm sorry, Matt. Maybe if I'd been able to stay with him, he would have thought about what she looked like, or where she was when he watched her. I could try again.
No. Ben's voice was level. Not now. You might not have been tired before, but you're exhausted now. And you're still shivering.
Cassie still refused to look at him. I didn't give you anything helpful. I have to try again, and soon, or else he'll kill that poor girl, and God knows how many others.
Killing yourself won't help us.
I know my own limits, and I'm stronger than I look.
Are you?
Yes. The sheriff's gaze had been shifting from one to the other as they spoke, but when Ben didn't respond to her last flat statement, Matt said,
"If we're lucky, a few hours won't make a difference. Why don't you get some rest, and we'll try again later this afternoon. The stronger you are, the better our chances of learning something useful, right?"
Cassie wasn't an idiot. "Yes. All right."
Ben said, "Promise you won't try on your own, without a lifeline."
Cassie wanted to point out that most of her contact with the killer had taken place without benefit of a lifeline, but something in Ben's voice warned her that he wouldn't be happy with that reminder. "All right.
Promise."
"I just did." Ben drew an audible breath, then said,
"Matt, would you give us a minute, please?"
"Sure. I'll wait in the car."
Cassie watched the sheriff leave the room. She listened to the front door close quietly behind him, and when the silence had dragged on too long, she finally looked at Ben.
"What's going on?"
he asked quietly.
"What do you mean?"
Her voice sounded evasive, even to her.
Ben frowned. "You want a list? All right. Last night, you were perfectly comfortable with me. Today, you are obviously not. You don't want to meet my eyes. You don't want to touch me. You're a million miles away. Cassie, I don't have to be a psychic to know something's changed. What is it?"
For just an instant, Cassie was tempted to tell him the truth. "I was mooning over you like a silly schoolgirl, and now I've stopped. That's all." But even though it was her nature to be honest, she found herself unable to tell him that. Instead, she heard herself say coolly, "Nothing's changed, Ben."
"And last night?"
She wasn't entirely sure what he was asking, but answered anyway. "I think they call that the quiet before the storm.
She shrugged, conscious once again that she was wrapped in a blanket, virtually immobile. And he was too close. It made her feel restless. And it made her talk too much. For a little while, I forgot about that madman out there. I forgot about responsibilities and keeping my guard up and the necessity of being alone.
Who says being alone is a necessity?
It is. For me, it is. Always has been. She wanted to keep it light, make it casual. But she knew she sounded just plain miserable when she added, "Oh, just go away, Ben. Please." He leaned toward her suddenly, one hand lifting to touch her face.
"Don't ask me to do that, Cassie."
She went utterly still, staring up at him. His face was somehow different, as though some part of him she'd never seen lay exposed on the surface. She didn't know what it was she saw, but it stirred something in her that had never been awakened before.
"What is it about you?"
he murmured, obviously more to himself than to her.
"So guarded and wary, so aloof and afraid to be touched. Yet I can't help wanting to touch you. Needing to. Maybe you can't read my mind, but I can't get you out of it, Cassie."
His fingers traced the line of her brow and jaw, his thumb brushing across her cheekbone. And when her body shivered in reaction, Cassie understood that one of them was playing with fire. "You really should go," she managed to say unsteadily.
"I know."
Ben's hand now cupped her cheek, his thumb rubbing slowly back and forth across her lips, and his eyes intently following the movements.
"Believe me, I know. I know the timing's lousy, that it'll take all your emotional energy to do what we're asking you to do. I know you're tired right now. I even know I'll probably make you a lousy lover, given my track record. I know all the logical, practical reasons I should go away and leave you alone.
But..." She was surprised the word emerged coherently. His husky voice was as much a caress as the touch of his fingers, and her body, which had felt so cold only moments before, now seemed feverish.
"But I'm having a hard time convincing myself to be sensible about it."
His mouth brushed hers very lightly and then retreated.
"I want you, Cassie. I didn't plan on this, and God knows how it'll end. But I want you. And I have this feeling that if I let go of you now, I'll lose you for good."
"I'm not going anywhere."
"You've been trying to hold me off, shut me out. Do you think I can't feel it?"
Cassie resisted the urge to press her face against his caressing hand. "For your sake, as much as mine. Trust me, Ben. I'm the one who'd make a lousy lover. I wouldn't be good for you. I wouldn't be good for any man."
"Maybe I'm willing to risk it."
"Maybe I'm not." His eyes were heavy-lidded and darkened, and so intense they seemed to pull at her.
"Somehow, I don't think either of us has a choice."
There was something almost reluctant in his voice, and it made her say, "You don't know me."
"I know all I need to know."
"No, you don't. You don't know, Ben. I have too much baggage. Too many monsters dragging at my heels." She swallowed hard. "I can't..." His mouth covered hers, warm and hard and so unexpectedly familiar that she was helpless to prevent her own instant response. Hardly aware of moving, Cassie got her arms out from under the blanket and reached up to him. One of her hands pressed against his chest as though holding him off, but the other slid from his shoulder to the nape of his neck. Her touch was tentative, but not shy, and when he lifted his head, she made a sound of disappointment.
"Can't you?"
he murmured. "You aren't playing fair," she told him, bemused by the husky sound of her own voice.
"I'm not playing. Cassie, listen to me. For just a minute, forget about the rotten timing. Forget about that maniac out there. Forget about everything except the two people in this room. That was not very hard to do, she thought. In fact, it was frighteningly easy. All right. Tell me you don't want me. She drew a breath and let it out slowly. You know damned well I can't do that. He smiled.
Good. Then we go on from there.
Go on where? But she didn't ask what she suspected was an unanswerable question. Instead, she said, Do you have any idea how crazy this is?
You'd be surprised.
He kissed her, briefly but not lightly, then eased away from her.
I'd better go and let you get some rest, especially if Matt and I are coming back in a few hours.
She'd forgotten about that. She'd also forgotten that the sheriff waited outside, presumably in his cruiser with the engine running. Remembering made her protest die in her throat. Right, right. Ben seemed a little amused, but his eyes were still darkened, and his face still bore that oddly naked look she couldn't quite define.
I'll call before we come out here, but I'm guessing it'll be around 4 or 5.
Okay. I'll be here. He took a step away, but then hesitated.
Remember your promise. Don't try to reach this guy without a lifeline.
No, I won't. He didn't say goodbye. She watched him until he was out of sight and listened to the front door open and close. Then she just lay there on the couch, no longer cold or even tired, but uneasily aware that she had just turned an unexpected corner and had no idea what was waiting for her. Matt folded up his newspaper when Ben got into the cruiser and lost no time turning the vehicle around and pointing it back toward town. Neither spoke until Cassie's snowy driveway lay behind them, and then the conversation was brief.
If you want my advice, Matt began. I don't.
The sheriff glanced at his friend, then murmured,
Okay, then I'll just drive.
Chapter 12. The Plantation Inn was not bad as motels went, though Bishop could have done without the plastic palms that seemed to sprout from every corner. Still, his room was clean and comfortable. Limited room service was available. When the restaurant next door closed, you were on your own. And the desk clerk had been reassuringly knowledgeable when he had asked about fax lines and data ports. Accustomed to living out of a suitcase, he didn't bother to unpack his clothing, but he did get his laptop out and set it up on the fair-sized desk by the window, where the promised data port was available. By the time room service delivered his lunch, he had logged on and downloaded his mail and faxes from the office, as well as tapped into a North Carolina database that gave him access to past and current issues of virtually all publications from the area. He ate a club sandwich while reading relevant articles and editorials from the previous week's editions of the local paper, then checked several larger newspapers throughout the state. He found that recent news from Ryan's Bluff was not mentioned anywhere else. So, the sheriff had his town buttoned up tightly, at least for now. Instead of speculating on that interesting fact, Bishop reread the information he had gathered earlier concerning Alexandra Melton. There was little enough of it, just deed and title information on her property, and the major points of her will. It didn't appear that she had involved herself in any meaningful sense in town affairs, since her name made the local newspaper only when she died. But Bishop's information went back further than Alexandra Melton's life in Ryan's Bluff. In fact, it went back more than 30 years. In his file were a number of detailed reports, including several from various West Coast hospitals and at least half a dozen from law enforcement organizations. He just glanced over those, since the information was familiar to him, but spent some minutes looking at a detailed family tree going back nearly 200 years. Except for husbands, the tree was almost entirely female.
There had been few sons born to this line of women for generations, and seldom more than one daughter. Cassie Neal's name occupied one of only two boxes representing the current and only surviving generation. After studying the tree for a time, Bishop closed the file and shut down his computer. He called room service to come get his tray, changed into the very casual clothing that was suitable for exploration, and left the motel. He drove to the downtown area, since the Plantation Inn was some miles away. Snowplows had been at work to scrape aside the scant few inches of snow, even though the temperature had risen enough to begin melting it anyway. He avoided the slush in the gutters when he parked his car near the drugstore and got out. For a few moments, Bishop stood near his car and just looked around. There was a fair amount of activity on this Friday afternoon. Shoppers moved in and out of the stores. The car lot on one end of town seemed to be having some sort of loud and colorful promotion involving the giveaway of a television set, and the two restaurants he could see appeared to be doing brisk business. But he noticed immediately that no woman walked alone, and that the few children about were kept close to their parents, and that it was quieter than it should have been, with conversations kept low and no audible laughter. Not too many smiling faces, which he knew was unusual in this part of the country, and more than one passerby gave him a distinctly suspicious glance. He wouldn't have much time, he knew, before somebody official asked him what he was doing in town. Bishop began strolling down the street, visiting several stores, making small purchases at each, and speaking politely, if not affably, to the clerks who waited on him. Aware that he had a face designed by fate to make others nervous at the best of times, he made no attempt to ask questions, but rather listened in on various conversations going on around him, or at least to those that didn't stop abruptly whenever someone caught sight of him, as they invariably did. He heard the phrase, serial killer, spoken at least half a dozen times. He also heard several men declare that they were armed and ready should the bastard come after their women. It was a promise that didn't appear to reassure those of their women present to hear it. Bishop ended up in the drugstore, with coffee and a talkative young counterman who offered speculation about the three recent murders with ghoulish fascination. Neither encouraging nor discouraging, Bishop listened, saying only that it seemed like too nice a town to have such goings-on. Apparently feeling that this placid reaction implied criticism, Mike the counterman was quick to add the information that they also had a witch. Bishop sipped his coffee.
Really?
Yeah. Everybody's talking about her. Mike industriously polished the counter in front of his customer, just in case his boss was watching. Some say it's her fault, these killings. But I got it from one of the sheriff's deputies straight that she couldn't have done it. With her own hands, I mean. Too little. Besides, I think she had an alibi when Miss Kirkwood was killed.
If that's so, why would anyone blame her?
Bishop asked mildly.
Well, because she's a witch.
Mike lowered his voice.
Way I heard it, she knew there was going to be a killing and warned the sheriff about it. Judge Ryan, too.
Then why didn't they stop it?
Didn't believe her, is what I hear. Well, I mean, would you? But then Becky was killed, so I guess she knew what she was talking about, at least that time. What I want to know is, how's she doing it?
You mean, how does ESP work? Mike shook his head impatiently.
Nah, I mean, does she have a crystal ball? Some of them tarot cards? Or does she need the blood of a chicken or something like that? Keith Hollifield over by the plant, he's missing a few chickens just since last week, and he's been putting it around that maybe the witch needs them to see the future.
Has anyone asked her? Bishop's ironic tone was lost on the young counterman.
Not that I know of, Mike replied earnestly. But I think the sheriff should, don't you?
Absolutely. Bishop paid his check for the coffee and left Mike a reasonable tip, then strolled from the drugstore. A sheriff's deputy lounging against a light post outside straightened, eyed him speculatively, then politely asked if he was a stranger in town. Out of time. Smiling faintly, Bishop produced his identification. The deputy's eyes widened.
You'll be wanting to talk to the sheriff, I expect.
Eventually, Bishop said. But not just yet. Though the temperature hovered just far enough above freezing to begin melting the snow, the picture outside Cassie's kitchen windows was still a winter wonderland when she sat down to a late breakfast. Ben and the sheriff had been gone nearly 2 hours, but it had taken her some time to rouse herself enough to get up from the sofa. And when she finally did get up, she discovered that she was more tired than she had realized, and still a bit cold. A hot bath helped warm her, and by the time she apologetically fixed Max's breakfast and something for herself, she was feeling better. Physically, at least. She wasn't sure about emotionally. Years of experience had taught her not to dwell on the horrific images and thoughts that came to her telepathically, so it was easy enough for her to think about the killer with a hard-won degree of detachment. But knowing he had chosen his next target, and that he planned new torments for her, was not so easy to dismiss from her mind. Not easy, but entirely necessary in order for her to find some sort of peace. But this time, it required more than concentration. It required distracting herself with thoughts that were, in their own way, nearly as emotionally upsetting. Thoughts about Ben, and about what seemed to be growing between them. Cassie was still astonished to recall her response to him, and even more surprised by his desire. She didn't know how to explain it, any of it. With what she'd learned of men, and the things too many were capable of, she'd thought it virtually impossible to contemplate a relationship with this absurdly dreamy longing, with curiosity and eagerness. A sexual relationship, she assumed. Ben had made it clear he wanted her, though she was uncertain as to why that would be so. She was no fool, and she had read too many male minds not to know that they simply didn't look at her and feel desire. She was too thin, not at all pretty, weighed down with the baggage of nightmarish abilities, and laughably lacking in experience when it came to romantic relationships. In short, she was no bargain. And Ben. No question that he could get virtually any woman he wanted, and probably always had, despite the walls that kept him distant emotionally. He was handsome, intelligent, sexy, both compassionate and kind. He was an important man in town, a man people looked up to, and he was an elected official, which meant his life was open to public scrutiny. Something she doubted he had considered. No, it just didn't make sense. There were myriad reasons that she would be attracted to him, but not a single one to explain his interest in her. Except maybe as a novelty. Cassie considered that with all the detachment she could muster. A novelty? Something entirely different from what he was accustomed to, and therefore of interest? A woman who found his walls a relief when they might well have presented a problem for him in other relationships. She supposed it was possible. But if his attraction sprang from something so insignificant, he surely would have decided to wait until the threat to his town was past. He must have known she wasn't going to be running off with somebody else in the interim. Cassie stood at her kitchen window with her coffee and stared out at the pretty, peaceful scene, all too aware that once again her sense of expectancy had vanished. To Max, who was sticking close, she said, "I can talk myself out of a good mood faster than anyone else I know." Max thumped his tail against the floor and gazed up at her intently. "He just feels sorry for me. That's what it is. Or maybe he's just one of those men who gets a charge out of thin, pale women, always falling unconscious practically at their feet. Makes them feel extra macho or something. Although I wouldn't have said he needed that." Max whined, and Cassie reached down to scratch him between the ears. I've got to stop being unconscious around him. That's the second time he's carried me, and I missed it again. A woman dreams all her life of being swept up into a man's arms, and when it happens, twice, she's unconscious. Max licked her hand. Thank you, she said dryly. I appreciate the sympathy. But the truth is... I don't know what the truth is. All I know is that I'm about a breath away from making a fool of myself over him. And that scares me to death. Max nudged her hand firmly, obviously asking for more of the pleasant scratching between his ears. Cassie obliged. But you want to know what the really sad thing is? The sad thing is that I don't think being scared is going to stop me. I don't think anything is going to stop me. I think I'm going to make a fool of myself over him. Whatever Max might have responded, the ringing phone startled them both and cut off Cassie's confidences. She picked up the extension in the kitchen, said hello, and heard the unmistakable gruff voice of her aunt's elderly lawyer. Miss Neal? Hello, Mr. McDaniel. More papers to sign?
No.
Miss Neal? No. Probate was wound up quite satisfactorily. Philip McDaniel cleared his throat. Miss Neal, would it be convenient for me to come and see you after lunch? It won't take long, but if you could spare me a few minutes, I would greatly appreciate it. Cassie frowned slightly, although she couldn't have said why. I could come into town to your office, Mr. McDaniel, if it's important. For you to come all the way out here...
I assure you, Miss Neal, I would prefer to come to you. If it's convenient, that is.
Of course. But what is this about?
He made several vague noises, then said, Merely a small matter which... Well, I would prefer to discuss it in person, Miss Neal. Shall we say around 2:30?
All right. Fine. I'll see you then. Cassie hung up the phone and looked at Max. Well, what do you think about that? Max moved closer and nudged her hand, asking for more scratching. Deanna Ramsey hated living in a small town. She hated living so near the mountains. She hated living in the South. In fact, she pretty much hated her life. Especially now that some maniac was out there stalking women and scaring everybody so much that they'd gone paranoid. Her parents wouldn't let her leave the house without an escort. The principal wouldn't let any of the girls leave school grounds without an escort. Deputies were everywhere in town and pounced the instant a body ventured a step or two away from the escort. I hate my life, she announced in disgust. Her best friend, Sue Adams, giggled. Just because Deputy Stanford scolded you and ordered us to wait in the drugstore for Larry. Deanna heaved an impatient sigh. No, not because of him. He's a dork. I hate my life because my life is entirely hateful. Look, if we have to wait in here for my brother to get back, let's at least have a Coke. They ordered two Cokes from Mike and retired with them to the booth at the back, which was their spot. I don't know why you're so upset, Sue said. At least you have a brother to take you places, and at least he will. Both my sisters are still children. I won't have my license for more than another year, and Mama gets hysterical if I even mention the possibility of going on a date.
So does my mom. You'd think we were prisoners.
Well, Sue said reasonably, we are prisoners, more or less. Neither one of us is 16 yet. We don't have cars or jobs or boyfriends. Deanna glared at her and said in a lofty tone, Speak for yourself. On which point? Sue demanded.
Never you mind. Let's just say that if you were half the friend you claim to be, you'd talk my brother into taking us to the mall when he gets here, and then keep him occupied while I run a little errand.
But we're supposed to go straight back home.
And back to prison for the entire weekend, because Larry has to work, and you know nobody else will take us anywhere. Well, but nothing. I'm sick and tired of the whole thing. This has been the most boring week on record. I want to do something. What's the use of a day off from school if we have to sit at home all morning and then spend half the afternoon waiting for Larry in the drugstore?
Sue stared at her.
What are you up to, Dee?
Deanna shook her head but smiled portentously.
Like I said, I just want to stretch my legs at the mall. But Larry'll never take us if I ask, so you do it.
Sue began to feel apprehensive.
Dee, there's a real killer out there, and nobody knows who he'll go after next. Oh, for God's sake, Sue, I'm not going to wander down any dark alleys or even leave the mall. I'll be right there, practically in your sight, safely inside and surrounded by other people. I just don't want my big brother looking over my shoulder, that's all. Who are you meeting?
Sue demanded. Deanna conjured an innocent face. She'd practiced the expression for a good hour that morning while putting on her makeup.
I'm not meeting anybody.
I don't believe you.
Well, pardon me if I don't care.
Seeing that she was about to seriously offend her henchwoman, Deanna relented.
Spend the night with me tonight and I'll tell you everything, okay? Just ask Larry to take us to the mall before we go home, please. Why won't you tell me now?
Because.
Come on, Sue, you owe me a favor. Didn't I do your history homework last week?
Sue had an uneasy feeling the two favors hardly balanced out, but found herself giving in, the way she always did with Deanna.
You'll tell me the truth tonight? Swear?
I swear.
After a moment, Sue gave in.
All right. I just know I'm going to be sorry, but all right.
Deanna smiled blindingly.
You won't be sorry.
Judge Ryan.
Ben was accustomed to being stopped from time to time whenever he was out in public, but today it had taken him double the usual time just to walk from his parking place to the courthouse. He had made it as far as the third step this time. Wishing he had taken the back way in, he turned to find one of the more vocal citizens of the town approaching determinedly.
What can I do for you, Mr. King?
He and Aaron had known each other for 20 years, but Aaron liked titles, insisting they denoted respect. He would have continued calling himself Major after his army service, but he had discovered to his chagrin that others only found it amusing.
Judge, is what I've been hearing true?
That depends on what you've been hearing. Ben made sure his tone was easy rather than sardonic. Aaron scowled.
What I've been hearing is that Sheriff Dunbar and you have been allowing some woman claiming to be a fortune teller to advise you.
Ben was resigned. It was the fourth time he had heard some variation of the truth. And where did you hear that, Mr. King?
From at least 3 different people since yesterday. Is it true, Judge?
Not precisely.
Then what precisely is the truth?
Ben paused a beat, briefly considered how much damage one angry voter with influence could do when election time rolled around again, then consigned the risk to the limbo of things unimportant and unregretted.
The truth, Mr. King, is that Sheriff Dunbar and I are investigating 3 particularly vicious murders. We are using all means at our disposal to gather information that might prove helpful in that investigation, as is our job. We are not gazing into crystal balls or reading tarot cards, nor are we talking to anyone who does.
Aaron ignored the denial.
I heard it was Alexandra Melton's niece.
Ben felt a chill. If this man had heard so specific a piece of gossip, then others had as well. Which meant it was only a matter of time before Cassie's identity was common knowledge throughout the town.
Is it true?
Aaron demanded. Ben wasn't a politician for nothing.
Is it true she's a fortune teller?
Of course not. Aaron's scowl deepened.
She doesn't claim to be able to see the future?
No, she does not.
But you and the sheriff have been talking to her about these killings.
If we have. The interviews are part of an ongoing investigation, and hardly subject to public discussion, Mr. King. As you, of course, know. Aaron also respected, to excess, in Ben's opinion, the red tape of a bureaucracy, and so found himself caught between rampant curiosity and the unhappy knowledge that he was in no way part of the official loop of persons involved in the investigation. He drew himself up to his full height, which was a good 5 inches shorter than Ben's, and said self-righteously,
I have no intention of interfering in the official investigation, Judge.
I'm glad to hear it. Aaron wasn't finished.
But if it should come to light that you and the sheriff have allowed yourselves to be deceived by a charlatan into pursuing false leads, placing even more of our women in danger from the resulting delay in apprehending this killer, then, Judge, I won't hesitate to add my voice to those calling for your resignations.
Ben wasn't tempted to laugh, even though the speech had obviously been rehearsed and was delivered with condescending relish. Aaron King was a pompous windbag, but he had the knack of rallying others around him, and considering the tension of the townspeople, it was likely he could gather quite a mob to demand action if the investigation didn't soon result in an arrest, especially if there was another murder. Calmly, Ben responded,
And rightly so, Mr. King. If we don't do our jobs, we should step down. But, I assure you, we are doing our jobs. Thank you for your opinion and your interest. I'll pass on both to Sheriff Dunbar.
Faced with courtesy, Aaron could only incline his head in stately acceptance, execute a turn with military precision, and march away. A grand departure somewhat spoiled by the fact that he slipped on a patch of ice in a shady spot on the walkway and nearly fell on his ass. Ben still wasn't tempted to laugh. In fact, he felt more than a little grim, and not because he feared losing his job. Cassie was becoming all too visible, and despite the wild mix of rumor and speculation concerning the extent of her abilities, it wouldn't require confirmation for at least one citizen of the town to view her as a dangerous threat. And he had more than a job to lose. Abby probably wouldn't have felt brave enough to leave the house on Friday afternoon, not after Gary's sudden and menacing appearance the night before, if it hadn't been for Bryce. But luckily for her, the dog was not only companionable, he was also well-trained. It was also lucky for her that the snow had closed numerous businesses for the day, including the financial services office where she worked, because otherwise she might have upset her boss by bringing her dog along.
I'll be much less jumpy by Monday, she told Bryce that afternoon as she backed her car out of the driveway. We'll have a nice, peaceful weekend, and on Monday, the security company will install all the new lights. But right now, we have to go out to the mall and get that padlock and some chew toys so you won't eat any more of my slippers.
The Irish setter sat up like people in the passenger seat beside her and lolled his tongue out in a happy grin. He loved riding in the car. He wouldn't much like waiting in the car, Abby knew, but the mall didn't allow pets. It would be for only half an hour, though. Just long enough for her to do her shopping. The mall was safe enough, certainly. It was 2:30 on the dot when Philip McDaniel rang Cassie's doorbell. Since she had expected him to be prompt, he didn't seem to know how to be anything else.
Cassie was opening the door while his finger was still on the button. "Hello, Mr. McDaniel. Come in, please." "Thank you." He stepped aside, eyed the growling dog at her side, and said, "You can let go of him, Miss Neal. Dogs never bite me. I have no idea why, but there it is." He was a tall and painfully thin man of perhaps 70, with a snowy goatee and a full head of white hair, and there was an air of dignified elegance about him. Maybe it was that gentle composure that prevented dogs from attacking, or maybe it was just because there was so little meat on his bones. Reluctant to put either theory to the test, Cassie performed the usual introductions, and Max followed them quite happily into the living room. "Let me take your coat," she said to the lawyer. He was the sort of man who wore a trench coat on chilly days. Today it was accompanied by a muffler and kid gloves. But McDaniel shook his head and gave her a pained look out of grave eyes. "I can stay only a moment, Miss Neal. And truthfully, you may order me to go when I have explained my errand." "Good heavens," Cassie said mildly. "Why would I do that, Mr. McDaniel?" "Because I am guilty of a terrible breach of trust, to say nothing of duty and responsibility." He said it as though he fully expected to be keel-hauled or drawn and quartered for the crime, but since Cassie liked him, and since she couldn't imagine him deliberately harming anyone, she didn't hesitate to say, "I'm sure whatever you did was quite unintentional, Mr. McDaniel."
"That hardly absolves me."
"Well, why don't you tell me what it is, and then we can put it behind us." He drew a sealed envelope